I'm Deborah Owens. Welcome to Wealthy Radio. Tonight, Sue Rogan, Director of Financial Education at the Maryland Cash Program, is in studio with me tonight talking about the financial services, education, and coaching they offer to promote financial stability for working families. She will also talk about the upcoming Maryland Financial Education Summit going on next week. And in our second half, we'll talk with professor and author Tom Shapiro about his brand new book, Toxic Inequality: How America's Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility and Deepens the Racial Divide. All that and more in just a moment. But remember, if you want to join in this conversation, our phone lines are open. Join our conversation at 410-319-8888. You can also send us a tweet to @DeborahOwens with the hashtag WealthyRadioChat or leave a message on the Deborah Owens Facebook page. All that and more in just a moment. Gotta love some Aretha. Well, tonight, we want you to do just that, think. And I'm so excited because in studio with me is Sue Rogan. She's director of the Financial Education at Maryland Cash Campaign. And she's been dedicated to helping consumers and those in need of consumer and financial education for the past 25 years. She specializes in helping low-income residents by providing access to the tools, education, and support they need to drive financial success. Sue also serves on the Consumer Actions Advisory Board. She's on the Maryland Council on Cybersecurity. And, you know, with all that, she's also staff on the Financial Education and Capability Commission. She actually directs financial education and coaching to clients in substance abuse recovery programs, domestic violence shelters, community colleges. Well, in short, Sue does an awful lot. And I've known her for some time, and it's just so exciting to see how the Maryland Cash Campaign has grown. So welcome to Wealthy Radio, Sue.
Deborah, thank you so much for having us here.
Well, it's certainly my pleasure. But, you know, for the listeners who don't know, the Maryland Cash Program is actually an acronym, right? So talk to us about what that stands for.
Yes, it is. It stands for Creating Asset Savings and Hope. I think hope is probably our favorite part of our name because we really want to make sure that people know that there is hope, particularly when it comes to building financial stability or financial wellness. So we're an acronym and we try to work towards different avenues to help people build their financial wellness, both through advocacy, through capacity building and working with our great partners across the state, and with providing, as you were saying, financial education and financial coaching programs in Maryland.
Well, you know, it's interesting, too. It's the economy has gotten quite dynamic, and you know, typically what you could hope for is to go through high school or college, get out, get a job, and have that job for life. Whereas now, I mean, you have to really prepare for long bouts of, you know, maybe unemployment or, you know, or underemployment. And this new economy that we in has really put people in what I can like to describe as fairly tenuous circumstances. And then you look back and it's been almost 10 years since the housing crash, and yet we know some people haven't recovered. And so how are you helping people deal in this new economic environment we're in?
Well, and really good points, Deborah. As we know, you know, life happens, you know, maybe an illness, maybe, you know, one kind of crisis happens, and without having some kind of major cushion of savings, it can really hurt people. So what we're trying to do is provide, first of all, financial education classes. These are through our Cash Academy, which is www.mdcashacademy.org. And from the consumer standpoint, it's meant to be an umbrella of fact-based classes because, as you're saying, it's hard to learn about money. We may not learn it consistently in schools. We may not learn it consistently or accurately from friends and family. So we're providing these classes to give people a safe place without judgment to come learn all the different financial concepts that they may need to know to really build their skills.
Well, you know, I often say that to people at conferences. It's like there's so much shame around not knowing. Right. And so but how would you know? I mean,
exactly.
You don't learn it in elementary, middle school, high school. You can go through college and still have no exposure, particularly to investments. You know, I got an MBA from a pretty, credible organization. And they didn't cover anything in investments. Now, I got microeconomics, you know, some high level mm-hmm. accounting. But because I did not concentrate in finance and my concentration was in management, that just didn't seem to be part of the curriculum. And so you think about that, and it's no wonder people are having a hard time navigating through what has become a pretty complex financial marketplace.
Exactly. And it's gotten more complicated as time has gone on. So even if you had learned about investments, you know, when you went to school, it would all be very different now.
Yes, very different. And yet, you know, the other other trend that has really created a sense of inadequacy for many people has been this shift from pension plans to now you've got to manage your 401k, your 403b. Now you're responsible for it mm-hmm. and you don't really know what you're supposed to be doing.
And we're even seeing, studies have shown that young adults are actually timid to get into the investment world. You know, they're still dealing with the ramifications of their student loans, trying to figure out where to live, how to manage, you know, the money and everything. So we really do a lot around the psychology of money. So, you know, why is it that you're thinking about not investing? Is there something that's holding you back? Or, you know, why isn't that we haven't really thought too much about creating a spending plan? You know, that kind of basic building stone to building your financial wellness is knowing where your money's going and telling it where to go versus it just going out.
Yeah, I really call that, you know, saying no to some things is saying yes to yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And that's really what a budget does. It allows you to say yes to yourself. And yet so many people look at it as it being a constraint. But, you know, the other thing I find interesting, too, is young people are feeling like, oh, well, I don't want to buy a house. I don't. And I think that their perspective is through the lens of seeing their parents go mm-hmm. through this economic downturn. Some of them lose homes, foreclosure, mm-hmm. stock market going down. And so if that is what you have seen your immediately family been impacted by, it's no wonder there isn't some intrepidation around investing and doing anything that takes some kind of long-term commitment.
Sure, sure. And, you know, as we help people understand what their money personality or their money values and habits are, we understand that it comes from both your personality and your experiences, right? What you saw around you, friends and family, you know, it comes from your culture, it comes from media. There's lots of different things that weigh into how we form our financial decisions, but we need to have some space and time to process that to make sure the ones that we're making are the healthiest for us.
So I know you've the Cash Campaign has been delivering financial coaching to people as opposed to before it was a counseling, right? You know, you help them figure out a budget, and now you're talking about coaching and bringing in the whole attitudes, behaviors, and beliefs into the discussion. Talk to us a little bit about your perspective on, you know, counseling versus now what you're doing, coaching. What's the difference and what kind of outcomes are you seeing as a result of it?
And, you know, you're right. They're very different processes and programs. And counseling is very directive, as you're saying. Here's what we're going to do. You're going to do this. You're going to come back to me. That's kind of in a really different sort of relationship. Coaches really help support the person. They do not tell them what to do because, you know, as we all know, Charlie Brown's parent, wah, 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 we don't listen to him, right?
Yeah.
So coaches are there to say, what are your financial goals? What are your expenses this month? What's your budget? We use an online platform called My Budget Coach, where a coach and their member can meet once a month for up to 12 months for free and go over exactly that, their goals, their expenses, and their spending. And what we're seeing is with people participating in coaching, they are saving more. We did a research pilot project of this, and our members saved a little over $69,000 collectively and paid down a little over $54,000. So they're paying down debt, they're saving money, they're reaching their goals. Coaching really works.
And so why do you think that is? So, you know, it's one thing to do a budget, you know, so you know what you need to do, but oftentimes you don't follow through with it. So talk to us about how the My Budget Coach system is set up and why that has been an effective way to see better outcomes with people.
So just the coaching model in general of meeting with that person and knowing that you have to come back to them in a month with whatever work or commitments that you made in between tends to lead people to do those commitments. You know, we know it's
so
not going to happen.
Accountability.
It's the accountability.
Got
absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Not every single time, right? But the majority of times they are going to do that. And the one thing, neat thing with this program is because it's online, people can meet either online only where they screen share, or if they want to, they can meet in person. And if it's snowing here, we know what happens here when it snows, they can decide, okay, today, although we're going to meet in person, let's do it online. So it makes it convenient.
I want to invite our listeners in on this conversation. So if you're just joining us in this first half, my conversation is with Sue Rogan. She's Director of Financial Education at the Maryland Cash Program, which is an organization that provides coaching and help around personal finances and budgeting, and all designed with the objective of helping people become more financially stable. So perhaps you're listening to this program. We'd love to hear from you this evening. 410-319-8888. That's 410-319-8888. I'd love to hear from, you know, the question I have are like, what are some of the things that really cause you to go kind of off the rails, you know, like, you know, you bust your budget? I mean, is it keeping up with the Joneses? I mean, again, I'd love to hear from you. 410, how many of you actually have a budget and stick to it? How many of you have learned how to manage a budget? And then my other question is, you know, what do you think a coach would be of benefit to you? So the phone lines are open, 410-319-8888. We're talking with Sue Rogan, Director of the Financial Education, and she's talking about some of the phenomenal work that they've been able to do to help people save more, pay down debt. Do you think that's something that you would benefit from? 410-319-8888. So talk to us a little bit, Sue, about how do people find you? I mean, what do you have to do in order to gain access to the services that your organization is offering?
All right, so our main website is www.mdcashacademy.org.
Okay.
All of our classes are listed on there. People can register on there. If educators are out there and would like to teach, we're more than happy to have volunteers. There's a volunteer application on there as well. Same thing with coaches. So people can reach out to us and be matched with a coach, whether it be online again or in person. And they can actually email me directly at sue@mdcash.org, and we will connect them with services.
Excellent. And so can I, if I really feel like I have, you know, the inclination, or I feel like that's an area that I find that I can really help people in just managing their finance. How do you become a coach?
So interesting. So our coaches and our educators, either one of them, we are not asking that people have an extensive financial content background.
Okay.
We have curriculum that we will train our educators on, and our coaches go through training as well. What we need to find is people who would like to just help others manage their finances. A lot of the people working with us are like, you know what? I finally got to a place where I have some savings and I'm feeling less stress in life around finances, which is kind of the key, right? We want people to have confidence in managing their finances. I want to help somebody else get there too.
Interesting. How many people go through the program and, you know, have garnered some success and then want to help others? Does that happen?
We have. We have coaches who have graduated. They went actually the whole 12 months and then have then become coaches themselves to help others go through the program.
And talk to us a little bit about what that, you know, what do you learn? Like, what is that curriculum like? I mean, when you hear curriculum, sometimes you feel like, you know, do I really want to go? What's it like? Because I find that people have a phobia around numbers. Like, they don't want to, well, I think there's a lot of anxiety sometimes just around maybe not knowing, but also when you're in a situation where maybe you don't have enough, you're stressing a lot about it.
Sure. And, you know, from studying behavioral economics, we know a term called scarcity, that when you're really stressing about money, you don't have the bandwidth to kind of step back and think, what's my, you know, best decision? So working with someone such as a coach can really be helpful to have someone point out, you know, you might want to think about this instead of this, you know, just to kind of not, again, not telling and not directive, but helping the person see the entire picture. So our curriculum for classes really incorporates activities. We know as adults, which is our main audience, you know, although youth are more than welcome, we know we don't want to just sit there and have somebody talk to us. We know the adults in the room have a lot of expertise in their own lives and in their own finances. So we bring out the conversations and the activities to make these classes fun and completely free of judgment. You know, again, how would we learn about money? It's because we want to go out and we want to seek out the answers that we need.
That's interesting. So what kind of activities? Give us a sense. You talked about just getting underneath people's values.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of activity would you do to help people, you know, kind of identify what they value and what's important?
So we always incorporate this because it always comes back to why we do what we're doing, right? You know, we can say, oh, I'm going to change, but then thinking, why is that? So one example that we have is an activity called Money Habitudes, which is literally a deck of cards with statements on them and then categories on the back. People read the statements, such as, when I go out to dinner, I really like to pay for everybody. So they put in a categories of, that's definitely me, that's definitely not me, or maybe that's me. And so they sort these statements into these, you know, different piles, then they turn them over, and then they sort them by the categories. And so there's like spontaneous, carefree, planning, security. So there's different sort of money personalities that kind of give people some insight as to, oh, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. So, for example, a lady that went through this, did the cards, found out that family was her money value and that she clearly was giving to them. Anybody who asked that needed something, she gave to them before she took care of her own immediate family.
Oh, I can't tell you how much I do
really
in work with women and yep. just trying to get them to really understand that really what you become is an enabler,
mm-hmm.
right? In that, I mean, you really do think you're helping people,
right?
But when in fact, you're really not helping them because you're not allowing them to take ownership
mm-hmm.
of or responsibility for some of their financial decisions. Again, the phone lines are open, 410-319-8888. I'm Deborah Owens, if you're just joining us. This is Wealthy Radio. And every Tuesday at 7 p.m., we talk about how you can build wealth, how you can spend, save, and invest to build wealth. And we try to make this a safe place to have this conversation. So I like to preface every show with this, and that's no question is a dumb question, only the question that's not answered. And so we want to hear from you, 410-319-8888. Perhaps you're struggling around this issue of personal finance, you know, budgeting, and I know there's a lot of shame around it, but again, this show is in a no judgment zone, and we'd love to hear from you if you've got suggestions, if you've got tips about how people can be more successful, particularly as it relates to personal finance. We'd love to hear from you this evening. Let's go to our first caller. Kim, you're on the air. A question or a comment for us this evening?
I guess a comment. Good evening.
Good evening.
Hi there.
I just got in the car. I was like, oh, this sounds like right up my alley and what I need. I need more so, I guess, like accountability, I hate to say it. My husband and I have totally separate, you know, banking accounts, so I don't know what he's doing. He don't know what I'm doing. And, you know, and I don't know, like this accountability partner would help. And I like some of the exercises that she was just explaining, you know, to make me focus more on what are my areas of need that I need to, you know, tone down on. We need to budget. We create a budget every year, but unfortunately we're not sticking to it. And unfortunately when unexpected things happen to our budget, we don't have that cushion set aside to help us, you know, when something unexpectedly happens. So that's why I would like to build that savings as well. So this sounds very interesting, this course. And if it's things that I can take and apply to me personally and directly, then that sounds like that works for me.
That's excellent. So then, Sue, how would she, what would you say to Kim? How would she connect with this and get started on this path?
So, Kim, I would say just email me directly or call me, or if you want to give me your number, maybe I can write it down if I can grab some.
Yeah, well, I tell you what we'll do. When you hang up, Kim, I'm going to have our engineer take your number.
Okay.
And
awesome.
Then we'll have Sue reach out to you. But definitely go, if you can remember this, go to mdcashacademy.org.
Mm-hmm.
.org, or just Google Maryland Cash Academy. It'll come up. But we'll make sure that Sue reaches out to you. And I'm so excited. Are you a regular listener? Or how'd you
It depends. Sometimes if I'm in a car at this time of the evening, or sometimes if I set my radio in the kitchen to 88.9, I try to catch at least, I'm going to say once. How often are you on? I think I can catch you maybe once a week.
Yeah, that's right. Every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. Yep. So, no, I appreciate your calling, Kim, and I just want to encourage you to, sometimes when the student is ready, the teacher appears, right? So I want to encourage you to follow through, and Sue will follow through with you. Thanks so much.
Look forward to talking to you.
Okay. So that was Kim. Excellent. And that's the whole point, right? To connect people to the resources that they need. And again, I know there's just a lot of shame around this topic, and it's difficult sometimes for people to ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
So give us a sense. One of the points that she made was that safety net. And you talked a little bit about that budget and having that emergency fund. And I saw this rule of thumb statistic that I thought was fascinating. And basically, the old rule of thumb for emergency savings used to be 3 to 6 months. But the HR.com, humanresources.com, a career site, had this rule of thumb, and they said that for every $10,000 in earnings you have, that's how many months savings that you, expenses you should have in an emergency fund, because the higher your income, the longer it's going to take you to find a job to replace it. So, for example, if you make $30,000, you should have 3 months. If you make $60,000, you should have 6 months, because you, in this new environment, not new or anything, but in this evolving dynamic economy that we're in, it is taking people longer to find work. What are you seeing, Sue?
Sure. And I think that's, rule of thumbs are really helpful, I think, and just kind of generic advice to kind of have in our minds and stuff. And certainly, I think you're right. The higher income, the harder it is. Another thing to consider, though, is while you're creating that savings and growing it, consider making a contingency budget. So as soon as income stops coming in, and we've been working on a project for those who've been long-term unemployed, and some of them shared with us that they didn't cut spending right away because they had that either severance or emergency savings, they kept up at their same spending. So immediately shut down X, Y, and Z, whatever it can be, clothing, certainly going out to eat, maybe anything that can be let go, cut it down, because you don't know what it's going to take to get back to that
income. That's great advice. And so that's interesting. That safety net can give you a false sense of security, right? So if you begin to adjust at the exact time at the exact time that you see some semblance, some change in your economic situation, you need to be able to adjust immediately. Again, if you're just joining us, we'd love to hear from you. We've got a few more minutes with Sue Rogan, Director of Financial Education for the Maryland Cash Campaign. We're talking about the resources and services you can have access to if you finally want to say, I'm going to take a stand and take ownership, and I'm going to make sure that I get my financial house in order. Again, the phone lines are open, 410-319-8888. That's 410-319-8888. I would love to hear from someone who perhaps is listening and maybe has interacted with the Maryland Cash Campaign. You guys not only do these kinds of services, budgeting and coaching, but you also have different events throughout the year. So you've got to, I know that there's no space available now, but you talk to us a little bit about this summit that you do every year and who it's for.
So along with the Cash Academy, from the consumer standpoint, to provide that safe environment for classes, we like to support educators and our partners who are delivering classes so that we can connect and coordinate all of their work. It doesn't make any sense for somebody to have a class on credit on Tuesday, somebody else right down the street on Wednesday. So let's coordinate this. And what we try to do is to also really bring best practices to financial education in Maryland. So the Financial Education Summit is coming up on April 25th. It is a free event. It runs from 8:30 to 3:30 in Columbia, Maryland. You can get to it from our website again, mdcashacademy.org. And we have great presenters from national perspectives, a lot of research on financial education and what works and what doesn't. We have behavior economics. The Ideas 42 is coming. They're a great group. We have the keynote speaker is the National Endowment of Financial Education, or NEFI. So really just trying to make sure that we're bringing, again, that research and best practices so that our partners and educators can take away with what's the latest in credit or what's the latest financial education tip that works.
So that's interesting, because you've been doing this a while, Sue. And so what, from your perspective, how are things changing, and what do you think from a practical application standpoint is producing the best outcomes for people who are struggling and getting and it's effective at getting their finances in order?
So I would say that having the knowledge and resources and skills to going to financial education classes, there are people who can go to that and leave going, okay, I got this. I understand what makes up my credit score. I'm going to build it now from here. And then there are other people who said, you know what, I really need somebody, again, to work with me. So we were so excited to be able to bring coaching here, because paired with the two together, that really makes a big difference. You know, as the caller was saying, as Kim, you know, having the accountability, having somebody working with you. So I really think that financial education works for some people. I've had people call that say, I thought they wanted a coach. They're like, nope, I just want a class. Okay, if that's what you can do to make it work for you, great. If you need extra support, we have that too. So just having the different programs that people can access depending on what they need seems to really make a difference.
So, you know, and your point is it's no one size fits all, mm-hmm. right? It kind of is going back to the money habitudes, cards, and what kind of person are you, you
right.
know? And I always think about, you know, from the standpoint of what kind of learner are you, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, some are, what is it, kinesthetic, you like writing things down, auditory or maybe you
visual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I think that the same thing would apply in this case as well.
Absolutely, and we actually incorporate all of those learning styles into our classes, because we know that, you know, I cannot go for myself to a conference and not have a PowerPoint. I need to see something to learn. I can't just hear it. So people need to hear it and learn it in different ways, and we incorporate that into the work that we do.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the approaches that I've started to integrate in the talks that I'm doing is more gamification, really getting people engaged in the learning, mm-hmm. you know, question or answer or Jeopardy kinds of format.
Yeah.
That seems to really engage people in a way that now they're involved, right?
Right.
And they're so I guess the point would be, they are active as opposed to passive.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about that?
I think that is critical in any kind of education classes that people are putting on. The ability to connect and talk with other people and say, oh, yeah, I tried this and it worked for me. To learn from others. In every class that we teach, it's like a co-learning experience. There's a lot of, again, expertise in that room. So making sure that we're giving them time to connect together and to share their stories and learn from each other.
I love that. There's wisdom in the room. Indeed, indeed. Well, Sue, I can't believe it, but we're out of time. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks again, Deborah.
Yeah,
really
always
it.
Love the work you guys are doing. If there's any way that we can support you in making the kinds of services that you have available to people. And all of it is free, which is just, I mean, it's amazing.
We are funded by grants to do this work. So,
that's really exciting. Well, folks, don't go anywhere, because in our second half, we'll talk with author and professor Tom Shapiro, who has been generating lots of buzz around his brand new book, Toxic Inequality, How America's Racial Wealth Gap Destroys Mobility, Deepens the Racial Divide, and Threatens Our Future. Don't go anywhere, folks. In our second half, we'll be right back.
Here we go again. Trayvon will never get to be an older man. Black children, they childhood stole from them, robbed of our names and our language. Stole again. Who stole the soul from black folk? Same man that stole the lamp from cheap black smoke and made the whip crackle on our back slow. Made us go through the back door and rap for black.
Yes, well, welcome to Wealthy Radio. I'm Deborah Owens. The American dream has remained elusive for African Americans and people of color, and scholars and experts have examined these topics for many years, and the fact is that black and Latino families are not able to generate wealth as quickly as white Americans. I can't wait to dive into this topic tonight with Professor Thomas Shapiro. He directs the Institute of Assets and Social Policy and is the Professor of Law and Social Policy at the Heller School at Brandeis University. He is the author of several award-winning books in the field of racial-based inequity, including his latest, Toxic Inequality. He is active in the National Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative, managed by Global Policy Solutions and Insight Center for Economic Development. And I want to welcome Tom to our airways once again. How are you?
Well, I'm great, Deborah. It's great to hear your voice on the other end of the phone again.
Absolutely. You've been busy. This new book is creating a lot of buzz. And I guess my first question to you is that I didn't realize that reading your bio, you've been interested in the topics of race and wealth since you were very young. Talk to us about that.
Deborah, you're my new best friend. As a graduate student, studying sociology for my PhD, I became my interest in social justice and passion around issues around racial justice really became deepened and took a turn with finding what the data really looks like, what's the story, what's the case, and ever since then I have been deeply passionate about these kinds of issues. But it wasn't really many years later, shall we say, the mid-1980s, towards the end of the 1980s, that with my best friend Melvin Oliver, who became a co-author, we gained access to information about what's the typical assets, wealth, and liabilities of American families. And it really was the first time that scholars or activists had any access to data like that for normal American families. And we kind of took off from there. And from there, the first real product that people might know was the book Black Wealth, White Wealth. And I have been following it up and trying to push the envelope and become as cutting edge as possible and stay deeply involved in pushing and helping to formulate a movement in the United States around closing the racial wealth gap.
So let's talk about that. Well, we know that there's been a number of different, inequities as it relates to race and wealth in America. If you kind of just look at the progress or lack thereof of African Americans and lack of access to many of the tools and assets that allow you to build wealth, you can see why this inequity continues to grow, right? But at the same time, I feel like in my lifetime that my life did get better, Tom. Do you know what I mean? Like if I could compare my parents rise in income to my own, I would say that that a number of different policies that I benefited from, whether it be affirmative action and access to college,
sure,
and then access to different programs in corporate America that were really looking to recruit people of color and women, right? And now there seems to be almost a reversal of that. I mean, I do a lot of work in corporate America, and I see less and less diversity. And what that really means is that, people of color are not getting, or and in some cases, women are not getting access to the opportunity to earn some of those incomes. And so do you think we're going in reverse now?
Well, I think it's sort of the classic story in a sense of both things are happening at once, and I think the real important success story to tell is the story around individual or family mobility, how much better many African Americans and Latinos as well are doing resource-wise in comparison to their parents and their grandparents. And that tremendous success comes, of course, on the heels of some very hard-fought civil rights victories and legislation.
Absolutely.
Coming out of the early and mid-1960s around access to jobs, finance.
Education.
Communities. Education was absolutely key to that. Coming out of that particular success, we began to see, and the economy was also really booming at the time, which is really a very important ingredient
yes.
to that story. That is, sort of the real opportunities were there. So that's when we began to see the emergence of an African-American middle class in particular that began to become have a higher rate of home ownership. Some folks, not a lot, but some folks moved to the suburbs. We see it in Prince George's County and other places like that. And we have all of those successes right alongside the classic dilemma of when we compare groups, whether it's men and women, but in this case we're really talking about race and ethnicity, when we compare groups in tandem with that success for some families, we do see a U-turn in terms of the gap widening. And we see this, for example, just a couple of, I think, important pieces of data for people to hang on to. The typical or median a white family in the United States today has $140,000 in financial wealth, whereas that median, again, half above, half below, right in the middle, African-American family has $11,000 in wealth, and the typical Latino family has $13,000, almost $14,000. That's a big gap, and to convert it to a figure that might be more meaningful to people, it's easier for me to grasp. The typical African-American family then has 8 cents for every dollar of wealth that typical white family has, and the Hispanic family has about 9.5 cents. And that's a long way to go to think about, well, what does parity look like in a situation where we're 8 cents on a dollar?
Yes, and it's interesting that you say that, Tom, because my thought was two things. As when we say average family, just in terms mm-hmm. of data, is that like if we were to take out, like if we were to look at a normal distribution, right? Is sure. the weight of that top 1%? Of wealth so heavy that it skews to that degree?
Great.
Or is it that if we were to take those the very low income and the very high income and look at that average, would we see the same thing?
No, that's a great question.
Okay.
So the data I just cited is median data.
Okay.
It's not mean. So if Deborah, if you and I are sitting in a room and Bill Gates walks in, someone might say, well, the average wealth in that room now is $8 billion.
Yes.
What's the issue here? But Bill Gates walking in the room doesn't change the
Okay. Room. Okay. Well, you know what? Here's the other thing that I find, because I've followed you for a long time, and I'm so committed to closing this wealth gap. I do believe that part of it is a knowledge and execution gap, but I can't argue with the fact that if you don't have enough assets where you have some discretionary income through which, right, you have assets available to invest, right? And the less you have, the less risk you are, just from a practical standpoint, can take, that's not having some impact. But I think I think it was in your last study, and now it's even more prominent, is this whole the idea that the lack of inherited wealth is one of the reasons that the wealth gap continues to widen.
That's absolutely correct. For me, in the way I think about the black-white wealth gap, inheritance is really one of the keys. I mean, with a gap this large, you know, 140,000 to 11,000, there are a lot of cuts to that bleed, and there are a lot of things we could talk about. But I think it is important to try and grab what we think are the biggest factors, the biggest
yes.
drivers of it. And you mentioned a couple, but let's focus on the last thing that we brought up in the conversation, that is inheritance. You know, wealth is really different from income in that income really can't be passed along from generation to generation.
That's right.
It doesn't have that kind of legacy component. Wealth does, and wealth is passed along. And that really, I think, opens up a window to our past as a society, as a nation, in a way that allows us to link that past to what's, you know, and put it right on the table in contemporary times and say, what's the relationship? And we can see it in this kind of way in previous generations for African Americans, to take the example. It was almost impossible for African Americans to generate any financial wealth and keep it in terms of not being allowed to buy homes in certain communities.
That's right.
Business development was very difficult in some cities. Where,
yes, assets where, to capital, all of
yep.
it, you know, and not only...
the whole ball of wealth.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
So what the current data look like on inheritance, following the same set of families for 29 years, in a pretty random sample of the population, whites inherit about five times more often than African Americans do.
Wow.
And when they do inherit, and I'm talking about people who inherit 10,000 or more here.
Right.
When they do inherit, both blacks and African and whites, the African American family inherits $30,000 less. So we start off with, you know, if we want to think about kind of time one, what the legacy here is, there's a huge disparity that goes back to the, you know, grandparents and great grandparents and.
Yeah, and if we were to, and if we were to layer on just policy, right? So if we were to look at tax planning, part of that is also estate planning, right? So it's one generation having the benefit of passing those assets on without there being any tax consequences, and wanting to do that, right, specifically to benefit themselves, right? But if, you know, so what is the number now? I don't know. I know it used to be $20,000 a spouse and the husband could give away and there not be any estate taxes. So, those kinds of our tax laws then incenting that behavior, right?
Right.
It does.
It's $14,000 per individual, which can be repeated every single year.
Yeah, yeah. So I know it was $10,000. Yeah, I'm thinking the two. Yeah, yeah. And so you know, when you look at, you know, I used to argue that public policy had less to do with it, but yeah, if you look at how our whole tax system, well, how you look at W-2 income, right, versus capital gains, and that in itself puts working people at a disadvantage in accumulating wealth.
Absolutely, it's a payroll tax, and it's highly regressive in that way. And you know, as I think you know, we know, and I'm sure most of the listeners know, the payroll tax, Social Security tax, there's a ceiling on it. When your income is above, I think it's $113,000.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And the fact that we don't means test Social Security, but that's another story. I want people to join this conversation.
Sure.
If you're just joining us, I'm so excited to have Professor Tom Shapiro back on the air with us once again. We're talking about his new book, Toxic Inequality, and we'd love to hear from you this evening. The phone lines are open, 410-319-8888. That's 410-319-8888. So I guess the question to our audience this evening is this racial wealth gap such a divide, and is there a silver lining? I mean, are there any solutions to it? I'd love to hear your questions for our guests this evening, 410-319-8888. Let's go to Jean, who's been holding. Gene, thanks for calling in. Question or comment for our guest this evening?
Sort of have a comment question.
Okay.
Okay, you know, briefly, I worked in banking through the 80s and the 90s and, you know, early part of the 2000s. And originally, the pension programs were such that they, you know, banks were first to realize that there wasn't enough money on the back end to pay people, you know, their pension programs because it was, you know, it was just, you know, too much money to pay to those who had input money. Am I not correct in my observation?
Yes, you are, Gene. Absolutely
okay.
Correct.
So, you know, then they came up with the 401k plan. And I think one of the reasons why, I guess, you know, in general, people in general don't have, you know, the money or wealth that they could have accumulated is because they didn't max out their 401ks and taking advantage of the, you know, the matching money that the employer provided. I did, and I learned to live, you know, partially on saving, you know, like when I got an increase mm-hmm, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I saved, you know, mm-hmm. a portion of that. And when I could, I saved, you know, most of that. So now that I'm retired, I can see, kind of see the benefit of doing
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
My son,
Gene.
Who is, you know, a lot younger, he, you know, I encourage him to use the same kind of strategy. And at 23, he's been able to, because he lives at home and takes advantage of all the wonderful benefits we have for him.
You know, smart man.
Yeah, so he, you know, he can save money. So he's been able to save a substantial amount of money of the, you know, and he works and goes to school, so he doesn't have to accumulate, you know, the, you know, he still has some school debt, but not as much as a lot of people have because he pays for it. And, you know, and again, he's able to save. So, you know, say, to me, you know, my question. Well, you already asked my question. Do you feel that people are taking advantage of that, those matching funds, and maxing out, taking advantage of that free money that the employer provides?
Sure, that's a great question.
Okay, and, I'll listen to you off air.
Great, thanks so
You're
much.
Welcome.
In data we look at, retirement savings is depending on where folks are working, it's the second or third
yes.
largest sort of pot of wealth that they have. Right after home equity, and maybe we'll get around to that at before the evening's done. But Gene's absolutely right in that when people work for an employer that offers a retirement or a pension plan that is seeded, that is, the employer might contribute some to it, and especially if it's matched in any way, those are the kinds of automatic and default systems that most American workers actually generate financial wealth by. And a lot of those plans, you know, I work for a university. I'd like to take credit for the large amount in my retirement plan. I had no choice about it. It was totally mandatory. It was a system that put me into it. I had, you know, couldn't get out of it. And to this day, I'm happy. But that kind of system doesn't operate at most places of employment. Now, second point I would argue, not argue, the data tells, it's not an argument, it's a case, where African Americans are concentrated in occupations and employment sectors. It is exactly those places of employment where employers less often offer retirement savings plans, much less ones that are seated or matched.
That's right, and they're service industry, right? In some
more and
cases,
more, that's right.
Yes, and
more
so,
and, more, right.
And you know, I want to applaud though, Gene, because I think two elements were that I really are that he proved what I believe the argument is. If we're going to change, have some impact, and in one. He set an example for his son. So that knowledge that he was able to transfer in itself is an asset, right? And you know, as I see it, from generation to generation, if you don't have some kind of model that can demonstrate, right, how to save, you know, he basically, you know, lived beneath his means, that sort of thing. So I want to applaud him for that and for his son having the good sense to say, oh, well, Dad's done pretty well, I'm going to follow his lead. But I think the other aspect of that, and what we're not talking about, Tom, is I just saw an interview with the gentleman who created the 401k, and he's like, it's a monster. That's not what I created. See, when he created the 401k or that defined contribution plan, he thought it was an and. He didn't realize it was going to be an or. Right. And not only
That's
an
right.
or, but the tool of choice for retirement. And in fact, what employers really did was shift the risk to the employee, that retirement risk to the employee. And they were inadequately prepared to be able to manage those assets.
That's absolutely right. So the listeners maybe get a clear picture of that. There has been that what you referred to as the risk shift.
Yes.
And basically employers used to offer defined benefit plans. That is, no matter what happened, you were certain of a set amount each month, depending upon how long you'd worked and your last salary and all that. Employers did away with those. Not did away, but the transition to the more 401k-like plans are defined contributions. That is, what you get out is what you put in.
Yes.
And that's where the shift of the risk has really come on individuals.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Tom, I just saw a graph, and it showed that in, like, 1979, when the 401k was implemented, it's like 70% of employers offered a pension plan, and now it's shifted, right, to now 70%. I think I saw like 14% of employers even offered a defined a benefit plan or pension plan. But I want to go to our next caller. He's been holding
sure.
a bit. Jelani, you're on the air. Question or comment for our guest this evening?
I had a question. First of all, I want to thank you for this conversation. This is very intriguing, and I feel like it's very helpful, especially for me as a 27-year-old married young professional who is will be welcoming my first child in a couple months.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you so much. Jelani.
Thank you. So I'm looking at ways to sort of have her be prepared, you know, as far as when it comes to wealth and creating wealth for her in the future. So she won't have to sort of experience some of the things I went through when it comes to, you know, financial struggles and having to, you know, do loans for education. So you mentioned the difference between earlier, Dr. Shapiro, about, you know, the difference between African-Americans and white Americans. And what type of examples of wealth were passed on from, you know, through these families that, maybe, you know, African Americans didn't have.
That's a good question.
Sure, that's a great question. So let me talk about three things pretty quickly. The most obvious is inheritance at the death of a parent or grandparent, and those are, you know, that's the largest quote lump sum that gets passed along. But the other two we miss in the conversation. The second largest event that passes wealth between generations. Both in the black community and the white community, but much less so in the black community, is when a young couple like yourself buys their first home. Very few young couples have accumulated enough down payment to buy that first home while they're relatively young still. So we get financial help from parents and grandparents.
Absolutely.
And that's an inheritance. If you don't have to come up with that, if you have help from loving family who can afford to do it, I think we all applaud.
Can start earlier, right?
You can start earlier. The other way that money, large amounts of money, are passed along that we really don't count is what Jelani, I think, was one of the things he was starting to refer to, college education.
That's right.
If you come out of college with a $60,000 debt and you have the same job that Jelani has versus somebody who comes out of college with the same job but has zero debt because they were, you know, they won the birth lottery and their parents could afford their college tuition for them, that first year, you know, Jelani's first paycheck and his paycheck for decades is going to go, part of that is going to go to pay off that student loan, whereas the other person who tends more often, I don't want to overgeneralize, but tends more often to be white and upper middle class, That first paycheck is totally discretionary for them.
Yeah, discretionary, and they have the ability and the financial wherewithal to max out those 401k plans. And that's where I wanted to go with Gene, but I didn't. That whole, you know, discretionary income that you can make those choices. But, you know, we talk about, I think, and we didn't, Tom, we've got to have this conversation again. I think I just need to book you for the whole hour, because I think the other aspect we're not talking about is the appreciation of assets. That's real equity. That's real wealth. And so if you were to go into Prince George's County in Maryland, predominantly African-American county, same house would cost you less and will appreciate less over 20 years than in the community in, let's say, a Howard County, which is, you know, more diverse. And that is that's the question. I mean, that's the answer. I mean, that's the issue. I guess that's what I want to say.
Deborah, I think that is, you know, I've been saying it for decades, that's the deepest and the toughest issue, because what we are, you know, really have to put on the table is how housing equity is color-coded, precisely on top of, it's mapped right onto residential segregation. And the tough takeaway for me is that, you know, as you just said, African Americans, because of that, can perhaps purchase a home at less money, but it is not going to accumulate or appreciate in value nearly as much if the exact same home were in a relatively white community.
And, you know, it's interesting. I was just looking at, Tom, a documentary, and it showed a couple moving into a suburb of one of the boroughs in New York, and the borough initially being predominantly white, and when black folks moved in, they moved out. And so what they've seen is basically the equity in their homes be diminished over, you know, 30 years. And so they don't have those assets or that equity to pass on to that next generation
or white counterparts do. Yeah, or as much. And the foreclosure crisis hit moderate and low-income communities harder, and especially if that community was diverse, much less if it was community of color. And a lot of those communities have not really...
They haven't recovered.
Housing values have not gotten
back. No, they haven't. They're not even at parity at where they were in 2008. And the implications of that really was the inability to refinance because of loan to value and all of those issues. But, Tom, you know what? We're up to the... I can't believe this half hour went to... So quickly.
It flies.
Well, you know, I love this topic. Please tell folks your... you know, where they can get hands on some of the research and the data that your organizations have put together, and also the book.
Absolutely. You know, the book has been out almost a month now, and the title is Toxic Inequality. And in fact, I'm doing an event tomorrow in the Washington area at New America. The book is available. I always prefer people to buy it at independent and local bookstores.
I love it.
But if you need to buy it at Amazon or a larger bookstore, I'm happy to. But we want to drive that business to our own communities.
So you should have been at Politics and Prose. I'm going to follow you so that I know where you're going to be locally, and I can come out and see you face to face.
Politics and Prose is handling the book sales for me tomorrow, and they've done it in the past for me, and maybe there'll be an appearance in the next couple of months.
That sounds great. Well, keep us posted, Tom Shapiro. Always a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, and to your listeners, have a great evening.
My pleasure. Okay, folks, that's going to do it for us this evening. Thanks so much for listening to Wealthy Radio. That's it for tonight's broadcast. Many thanks to Susan Rogan and Tom Shapiro. A big shout out to the Wealthy Radio team, senior producer Samantha McCoy, engineer Andre Melton, and of course, a big thank you to my partner and husband and best friend Terry Owens. Next up, don't go anywhere. Get ready for the best in Latin jazz music with Fiesta Musical. The podcast of this week's show is available online at DeborahOwens.com. And make sure you go to DeborahOwens.com to sign up for our newsletter, learn about any speaking events, hear more about our Wealthy You Academy. Of course, follow me on Twitter. That's at Deborah Owens. Connect with me on my Facebook page. That's the Deborah Owens page. That's going to do it for me this evening. Good night, and have a prosperous week, everybody.